Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, Alan Finlayson, a political scientist with a specialty in rhetoric, discusses the similarities between Brexit and the victory of Donald Trump. And then Larry Cohen, chair of Our Revolution, the successor to the Bernie Sanders campaign, discusses the organization's plans for the future. Several prognosticators warned that just as the polls on the British referendum, whether to remain in or leave the European Union, badly underestimated the Leave vote, they're also underestimating Donald Trump's popularity. Those prophecies turned out to be right, and for similar reasons, a toxic mix of xenophobia with regional and class resentment, very unproductively expressed, carried the day in both votes. Yes, I know Hillary carried the popular vote, but as she and her highly professional staff knew all along, that's not how our elections are won in the U.S. There are also strong similarities between the two losing campaigns, fear-driven strategies with nothing positive in offer, designed by publicists who live in cosmopolitan bubbles. I too live in a cosmopolitan bubble, but I try to stay aware of that. What's this all mean? Here's Alan Finlayson, professor of political and social theory at the University of East Anglia in England, to help us figure it out. Feeling some deja vu over there?
Yeah, I think a lot of British people are, in that just a few months ago, we had our experience of a officially unexpected, unpredicted result representing some kind of reactionary populist rejection of liberal, neoliberal democratic capitalism. So yeah, a little bit of us is thinking, yeah, we've seen this coming before, but at the same time, I think this is also perhaps suggesting to us that what's happened in the UK was not a one-off, was not quite an exceptional result, but part of perhaps some kind of larger trend of what's happening in countries like ours.
I've been thinking along these lines, but also given pause by the fact that ours was different. It was an election between two people, personalities that were very different, with political platforms of some sort, as opposed to a simple yes or no in a referendum. Do you think that the similarities outweigh those differences?
Well, yeah, obviously one has to respect the specificity of particular countries' political arrangements and political situations, but I think it is interesting to observe the similarities between the two situations. And it seems that in both cases, the unexpected result comes in part from people turning out in higher numbers in certain areas where people don't normally turn out in high numbers, people who perhaps were not thought of as being particularly well connected to the political system, turning up and casting a vote as some kind of a protest. So that's definitely a similarity. Those people being, I like the phrase particularly, but white working class voters, that would seem to be a similarity as well. And of course, the fact that the whole thing is overdetermined by a politics around race and immigration, those things would seem to be similar in both cases.
The Remain campaign, as we spoke last week, you suggested that it had a lot of similarities to the Hillary Clinton campaign. A smug, very complacent, very upper middle class orientation to the campaign. Could you describe the thrust of the Remain campaign for us?
On the one hand, the Remain campaign primarily went for what here got mocked as Project Fear, for telling people that if they voted against remaining in the EU, all manner of disasters would happen. Now, that might well prove to be true. Nevertheless, it was a campaign that, because it's so concentrated on that fear, ended up inadvertently reinforcing the sense that voting for it was a vote for the establishment, and that voting Brexit had the anti-establishment cachet, would be a vote for change, would be a vote against the status quo and against the system. So that's clearly part of what went wrong for the Remain campaign. But it was also, as you say, the way in which the campaign reflected a particular series of culturally oriented class interests, if you like, certain ways of thinking about the world and one's place within it, celebrating a certain kind of cosmopolitanism that perhaps everyone doesn't experience as quite the joy that people in the big cities experience it. And I think also, though, I'd add into that a campaign that was really very, in a way, quite old-fashioned. And I think that this is perhaps also a similarity with what happened in the US. A very 90s campaign led by professional pollsters and professional campaigners using relatively mainstream means to try and capture voters, and not really realizing that people's attitudes, expectations would change, that online media was having a very different kind of effect in terms of mobilizing voters. There again would seem to be a similarity between what happened here and what's happened in the US.
And what about the figures of Nigel Farage and Donald Trump? Do you see any similarities between those two characters?
Well, I don't know how widely it's being reported in the US, but Farage here is making incredibly great play of his connections to Trump. It was reported during the campaign that he'd been over there and had spoken on behalf of Trump and had tried to make a connection between voting for Trump and voting for Brexit. He's the first, I think, so far only British politician to have been invited to meet Trump. There's been photographs in the paper of him grinning and shaking hands with Trump in front of elevator. From our point of view, there is a connection has been established between Brexit and Trump, and Trump's election is being used already to, in a way, revalidate the Brexit vote, to say, you see, it's not just us, but also to say that some of the fears here that we're going to lose out economically by pulling out of a free trade area and it's going to take such a long time to get other trade deals, suggesting that those fears are misplaced because now that Trump's in charge, you know, we'll be front of the queue for new trade deals. So from our point of view, there's very much a connection between the two issues. And in terms of the characters, while they're very different characters, both succeeded in presenting themselves as these outsiders, anti-establishment figures, people who would say the unsayable and speak the unspeakable and stick it to the man.
Farage, what, is a former banker?
Yeah, he was a merchant banker, and he's a privately educated person as well. Although the key thing about him, from one point of view, is that he's not a university graduate. So in that sense, he does in fact share something in common with a lot of the Brexit voters, one of whose defining characteristics was not being university graduates. That tells you a lot about age and about class, as well as about cultural attitudes and experiences.
But a merchant banker and, you know, Trump, a real estate tycoon, these capitalist characters who nonetheless present themselves as revolutionaries, it's not the first time, but it is a remarkable development.
It's not the first time, is it? But I think what's interesting there is that they both, in a sense, used their, particularly Trump, I think, maybe you can correct me, used their success as capitalists, in a sense, as part of justifying their radical position, that they were independent of the system, that they knew about work and business and finance, and then somehow parlaying that into a connection with those who were not benefiting from current economic arrangements, and then using that to build an alliance against the establishment of government bureaucrats. It's quite an extraordinary trick to pull off.
But there was an interesting piece in the Harvard Business Review, of all places, the other day, arguing that that the white working class in the United States admires the rich and really hates the professional managerial class. The real targets of their resentment are the professionals and managers who tell them what to do, whereas they admire the success of people who make a lot of money. They'd like to do that themselves. And admire the independence and that kind of, you know, FU spirit that people who make a lot of money can exhibit. Do you find anything similar among the Brexit voters?
So I did actually read that article as well, and it reminded me of, there are passages in Tocqueville, actually, where he talks about the ways in which the ordinary working man will mix with the rich man as long as the rich man doesn't put himself above the working man, speaks in the same kind of language, speaks in the same style and same kinds of tones. And there's something to that, I think, in the Trump case, and weirdly in the UK case as well, in that what Nigel Farage does manage to do when presenting as a political figure is precisely not speak the language of the professional political classes, is to speak in a more spontaneous, seeming, down-to-earth kind of ordinary language, and then make a great play of the fact that he's speaking in that kind of ordinary language, that he's just a kind of ordinary bloke. And so I think there is something about that. The class difference can be evaded if it's not demonstrated and performed culturally.
And there was a lot of confusion about just who the Trump and Brexit voters are, whether they're working class, whether they're above median income, whether they're, people don't use this language, but like some people like me, petty bourgeois. Do you have any sense of the class differences or parallels between these two bases?
So there is more data coming out as people look and see who it was who voted Brexit. And it is clearly, as I think in your case too, not quite as simple a story as it might first appear. It's not quite as simple as saying the poor and dispossessed voted one way and the rich voted the other. So in the case of Brexit, many of the constituencies that voted strongly for Brexit are better off than average. There's evidence to suggest that people of, as you say, petty bourgeois, middle income, voted for Brexit, and that the key predictors were really more to do with town versus country. So rural areas were much more oriented towards Brexit than city areas. It's to do with the kinds of employment that people have. It's stability, the autonomy they have in workplaces. It's to do with age, crucially. So older voters voted Brexit in much higher numbers than younger voters. As I said earlier, it's to do with university education or lack of university education, which can be a variable independent of income, particularly these days. And it's also, there's some of it suggest it's better correlated to attitudinal issues. So things that suggest people perhaps lean more towards authoritarian social attitudes. That lined up with Brexit in a way that those with a more anti-authoritarian mindset lined up against Brexit. Is that the same in the US? Do you find the same thing?
Well, it's really hard to read. I keep getting contradictory messages. People say, you know, the Trump voter had above average income, $70,000. But, you know, that's not all that high above average. Average household income here is about $50,000 or $55,000. So they're, you know, better than average, but certainly not rolling in it by any means. Geography seemed to matter a lot here, and especially there are some regions, particularly the upper former industrial Midwest, that have historically voted Democratic or close to it, that Obama carried in 2008-2012, which also some of which went for Sanders in the primaries, that nonetheless went for Trump or the general. And if votes had changed in some of those areas, Hillary Clinton would probably be the president-elect. Are these former industrial regions that were supporters of Brexit, or more just you know, the rural England of pastoral fantasy?
No, that's definitely part of the story, is the rural England of pastoral fantasy, but also definitely is post-industrial. It's very, very clear. If I could show people a map on a podcast, you could see that the large swathes of the east coast of England went for Brexit, and those are areas which were either fishing areas or ex-mining areas. There were unexpected votes for Brexit in South Wales, a strong ex-mining area. So there's definitely part of the composition of the Brexit vote was people who had worked in these kinds of large-scale collective working-class occupations that were often skilled and well-remunerated, connected to trade unions and the Labour Party, all of which have declined or fallen off the map altogether. And what you're getting there is sometimes people who retired from those professions, sometimes people whose families would have taken up work in those professions, in those jobs if they had continued, that there you're seeing a shift against the EU, which is also a shift against globalization, modernization, the transformation of work from industrial to so-called new economy and service industries.
I'm speaking with Alan Finlayson, professor of political and social theory at the University of East Anglia. Similarly, we hear a lot of explanations of the Brexit vote and the Trump vote, which revolve around racism and xenophobia, and these are undeniably true. There's certainly that large component of those things. How satisfied should we be with that as you know, the definitive explanation, or are there just many layers to this thing?
So I'm inclined to go for the many layers, and that's partly distinct groups bound together in voting for Brexit, some of whom might have been primarily voted by race and immigration, some of whom wouldn't, but also many layers to individual decisions, I think. But I think we need to not minimise the extent to which some people definitely voted for Brexit because of anti-immigration feeling. And then we have to unpack that a little bit and say, well, to what extent is that anti-immigration feeling a displacement of economic anxiety? Have people been persuaded to see their declining social position as caused by immigration? Or should we say that this is, in fact, out-and-out racism? So, again, the figures on how people voted in Brexit are contested, and the picture is not entirely clear. It is true from some of the research that areas where austerity had hit hardest were more likely to vote Brexit. So one paper came up with the suggestion that if in fact austerity had been decreased by about £50 a head in some areas, they might have shifted the other way in their vote. So that would suggest that perhaps where people are voting on the basis of immigration, it's really displacement of a much deeper economic insecurity. However, it's also clear that in areas where immigration had been quite rapid quite recently, a Brexit vote was more likely. So areas that were quite ethnically mixed were not necessarily going Brexit, but where there had been immigration, where there hadn't been much immigration before, over a short period of time, there you were finding people voting for Brexit. So that would again suggest that a motivating factor was some fear, anxiety, or hostility to immigration. And again, I don't think we can underestimate the extent to which some of it was, clearly was, simply racial hostility and some kind of ethnic nationalism, which we're seeing played out in different kinds of ways in our politics since, I think. But how about in the US, do you think? Is it a similar story, or should we see the racism as a byproduct, or is it actually a motivation?
I mean, it's hard to separate all these things. I mean, it just seems all wrapped up together. And Gary Young has been doing some good reporting for The Guardian. He spent a month in Muncie, Indiana, you know, that sort of Middletown, USA of the Lynn's sociological research, and, you know, found the whole array of things. He found the racism, but he also found a lot of anxiety, a lot of resentment to the fancy pants people who were telling him what to do, a sense that they've been disparaged by the cultural elites and resenting that. And then also a real Islamophobia, a distaste for Mexican immigration, although Mexican immigration has virtually ceased into the United States now. But still, there's this incredible mix of motivations. And, you know, look back at the Sanders campaign. He was able to reach some of the same people who eventually voted for Trump. We don't really have good numbers on how many, but, you know, certainly it's not a trivial number, who were excited by the positive appeal he made to, you know, social democratic program and class politics and a vision of solidarity. And the Clinton campaign, of course, evoked none of that and even ran against it in some cases. So people turned to Trump. So, you know, you have this very, very mixed bag. The same regions voted for Obama in 2012, voted for Trump in 2016. That's not a simple metric of racism there, but, you know, groups that voted for Barack Obama and then for Trump cannot be accused of pure racism. So it's really, it makes your head spin trying to figure this out. It's very important to figure it all out, but I don't think anybody really knows what's going on yet.
Yeah, it's the same in the UK. You can find evidence to suggest that that to some degree, black and minority ethnic voters voted for Brexit, and some did so out of hostility to immigration from within the EU, Eastern European migration, so which has been quite marked in the last few years. So there's all kinds of complications as to which different ethnic groups and which different migrant groups are responding to what and how people are responding and so forth, which makes the whole thing really super complicated.
The immigration in Britain is mostly what Americans would think of as white people, right? Poles, Romanians. We tend to think of race and skin shade together in this country. Are Eastern Europeans racialized in some sense in Britain?
Yes, I think certainly in some areas, definitely that is what occurring. That's because, and this is why it ties very much into the EU, because what's happened over the last 10 years is a kind of marked increase of people making use of free movement within the European Union, particularly from Eastern Europe, Poland, Romania, Lithuania, to find work in the UK, and also then moving to places where migrant communities were not already well established. So a lot of non-EU migration is people coming and moving to places where relatives, families, people from their home village and so forth are hometown. That's kind of making that's a very different kind of migratory pattern to the New Eastern European migrants, who often went to small towns, small places, agricultural areas where they could get agricultural work. And that's certainly part of what people have put forward as a reason for their Brexit voting. So in an area where I live in part of the UK called East Anglia, which is very white, but has quite, sometimes it has pockets of quite large immigration from Lithuania and from Romania, and some of the areas where that migration is quite concentrated voted highly for Brexit.
Now, you mentioned earlier the nature of the Remain campaign, very oriented towards fear and run by professionals. It sounds very much like the Hillary Clinton campaign, which was, they spent something like $1 billion. They had the finest political professionals in the business, and they came up with an incredibly dumb message and ran a very dumb campaign. They had nothing positive to offer or very little that one could point to. Yet it was all about how horrible Trump is. Now, Trump is horrible, but he also had some kind of appeal to a certain part of the population, which the Clinton people then wrote off with some contempt as the deplorables, which only worsened their troubles. This says something about the class nature of the two sides of these two battles, that we have this kind of professional managerial class versus a kind of rude working class. the policies that emerge out of these sorts of elections will not benefit that working class very much. Brexit is probably not going to do very much for the British working class. Donald Trump is certainly not going to do anything for the American working class. How do we read this, you know, this version of class struggle?
I wish I had an easy answer to that question. I mean, I think there's a kind of complicated set of things going on, isn't there? In that part of what we've got, certainly in the Brexit case, is some kind of protest vote. It's people registering a vote that is an objection to the status quo, that is an objection to that political class. So the alternative policies are not something that people are particularly assessing as part of what they think is going to be to their advantage. Now, I want to hesitate there and say that may be less so in the Brexit case, because it was a lot of people's view that because Brexit would lead to an end to immigration, that would change access to resources, housing, welfare, jobs and so forth. It may probably won't do that, but you could see why people might think that that would be some benefit they would get. In the cases of places that had once had large fishing industries, where fishing has declined in part because of the EU organisation of fishing quotas, you could again see why people might be making a judgment that they would be better off if those regulations were lifted. So there was some element of an interest calculation very specific to people's employment and occupation areas. But it does also seem that in some measure, identity has become an element of people's decision making in a way that we're not perhaps used to in the UK. Something to do with Englishness, something to do perhaps with white Englishness, with some kind of motivating factor. And I think that's a little bit new for us in British politics. But how about in the US? Did it feel like it was a kind of right-wing identity politics?
Yeah, there's certainly a large component of that. My friend Jody Dean, when I interviewed her last week, said she saw a sign in the yard where she lives in upstate New York, which is a very poor region, that said "Deplorable Lives Matter." And there are people who feel despised for their identity as being Hicks. They're despised for being bigoted. And then you had the Hillary campaign or some of her supporters or some of her supporting pundits feeding into all that by precisely pushing that view of these people as deplorable, as hopelessly ignorant and reactionary and violent. You get this assertion of identity, and then the reaction of this kind of liberal elite is only to confirm this sense of identity. There's nothing constructive going on in this relation at all.
Yes, I think part of that, certainly in Brexit, and my sense was it was similar in the US, was that the Remain campaign and the Clinton campaign were, in some respects, running an identity politics campaign and not realising that they were doing so. They didn't realise that what they were persuading, their attempts to persuade people to vote against Brexit really reflected on and relied upon having some sense of yourself as a progressive, forward-looking, liberal, internationalist-oriented cosmopolitan. And their reference points and their style and some of their jokes and advertising all really reflected a very particular cultural milieu. But they didn't realise that it reflected such a cultural milieu. And I think that in some respects then exacerbated the identity-based appeals on the other side. They were able to say, look at them, they don't care about you, they despise you, they belong to a different world to you, you should be voting on this side. So I think there was a sense that the identity politics dimension was kind of shared across both sides, if you like. And my anxiety, I have many anxieties right now, is I'm not sure the left in this country, all parts of the left, really recognise the extent to which that's a problem for them, and they need to begin thinking about a politics based not on constructing some sort of common identities, but some politics based on common interests, showing people they share certain interests in common and therefore ought to be working together on the same political side. I think we've kind of lost the language of interests to some degree in our politics. But I don't know how it looks from your point of view.
I'm speaking with Alan Finlayson, Professor of Political and Social Theory at the University of East Anglia. You know, the Hillary campaign very consciously used a lot of the language of campus identity politics. She had a tweet, which I suppose was produced by an intern fresh out of Brown, who said something about intersectionality. You know, this is not the language that's going to speak to the displaced machinist in Ohio. So they actually deployed that language very consciously and thought it was somehow progressive and would win them the election, when in fact it alienated the voters they needed to win that election.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking of Hillary, we have a situation a fairly similar situation in the U.S. and Britain, in that the Labour Party and the Democratic Party have abandoned largely any semblance of class politics in favor of a much more a professional managerial orientation. Hillary worked with Tony Blair on setting up the Third Way International. I mean, these guys, you know, they have a long history of a turn away from, you know, classic left politics and appeals to solidarity as well as interest. So is this, you know, does this reflect the failure of that kind of Third Way politics, you know, after maybe a delay of 20 years, but it all does seem to be falling to pieces?
Yes, I think it reflects that politics both failed in its own terms to fundamentally transform the political and economic landscape and to fully secure new kinds of social electoral coalitions to sustain itself, but also that it failed to change and adapt with the times. That's part of the irony, I think, that the Third Way certainly here was presented as modernizing politics, making it fit for the contemporary world, for the new world of digital and economics and the knowledge economy and so forth. But actually, it's entirely failed to keep up with changing social patterns, changing economic activity, changing means of communication and so forth. But I would say that one thing that's different for us is that our Labour Party is a little bit further along the road, perhaps, than the Democratic Party is, and that those people are no longer in power in the Labour Party anymore. We've had the paroxysm that comes after defeat came after the general election in 2015. So now we do have a leadership of the Labour Party that is talking a language of, or trying to develop a language around class politics. Although the party itself is deeply divided, the majority of the parliamentary Labour Party is not on the same side as its leadership, and there are issues about how the leadership itself is going to be able to organise and manage this kind of politics. We might be a warning of some of the crises that will engulf the Democratic Party as it tries to deal with this defeat and shift direction.
Yeah, the Democratic Party so far, at least the mainstream of it, and certainly all of the enthusiastic people who are cheerleading for Hillary Clinton, are blaming everything but themselves. They're blaming Putin and the FBI and people like me who were critical of Hillary. But they're not seeing anything wrong with the candidate or the kind of politics that she represented yet. There are some who do seem to be. Bernie Sanders was just admitted to the leadership of the Senate Democrats, which was a bit of a surprising development. But we don't certainly see anything like Corbyn revolution taking over the Democratic Party in the immediate future. Although, you know, I guess that was kind of a surprise to a lot of people in Britain. But
it was, yeah.
So what's the way out of this? Can, you know, in the 2 minutes left, is this just the way of the future and we have to hunker down? Or is the way neither Trump nor Brexit won by large margins? You could say that's not necessarily the way of the future just based on electoral returns. Do you see a way of breaking out of this, kind of a policy or rhetoric that would break out of this this right nationalism?
I don't see a simple way around it. And I think while one should remember that the vote in both cases was marginal, I don't think one should be complacent and think that kind of one more heave, one little modification of strategy would have pushed us over the line. Because I do think that both Brexit and Trump and things that are going on elsewhere in Europe, in Poland and in Hungary, the rise of the FN in France and so forth, are all parts of some kind of connected phenomena. They're all parts of the failure of globalization and the fallout of globalization politically and economically. So there's much, much deeper things in play. Clearly, part of the solution has to be some attempt to appeal to class-based interest politics, to people's experiences and lack of freedom in relation to work. It has to be something to do with organizing new kinds of workers, perhaps immigrant workers in the US, part-time precarious workers, find ways to bring them into some kind of broader labor movement. I think it also has to do with adapting to new media. One of the striking features of the Brexit campaign here was that it was in fact much, much better at using social media, and more data is coming out about how effectively it led on social media, led on Twitter and all these kinds of areas that you might associate with the urban progressive left were in fact enabling forces of the right to organize very effectively and push messages independent of the mainstream media that they hate so much. There's got to be something of a different kind of internet presence. But I kind of also feel that right now a lot of the politics of the future is going to be fighting an awful lot of different front lines. If Trump does pretty much any of the things that he says he's going to do, you're going to have an awful lot of quite challenging street-level politics, aren't you?
Yes. I mean, literally on the street. We've already gotten people beating each other up on both sides.
Yeah.
A friend of ours got harassed in a supermarket parking lot the other day, and I just read a story about somebody who beat someone else on the subway for wearing a Make America Great Again hat. So it's getting down to the very capillary level of politics.
And I think that's going to happen here in different kinds of ways. I mean, as you know, we're still waiting, in a sense, for Brexit to fully happen. Technically, it hasn't happened yet, but some of the economic fallout is already occurring. There has been an increase in race politics, but I think we're going to see new kinds of street politics around issues of both economic and to do with migration. And I think we're also going to be influenced, I think, by the American experience. A lot of people, we can all see what happens in America, and some, you know, there's a kind of resonance between what happens in your country and what happens here. So I think it's going to be a time of a sort of politics that is not unprecedented, but that many people younger than us are not familiar with.
That was Ellen Finlayson, Professor of Political and Social Theory at the University of East Anglia in the UK. Alan spoke of the change within the British Labour Party over the last year, notably the ascension of a serious socialist, Jeremy Corbyn, to the leadership, and wondered if that might be a portent of the Democratic Party's future. Maybe so, but there's a crucial difference between the two parties. Labour is a membership organization, and the members, many of whom joined expressly for this purpose, chose Corbyn. The Dems are run by an inner circle of professional politicians and their money bags patrons, so it's nearly impossible to imagine a Corbyn analogue taking control here. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has admitted Bernie Sanders to the Senate Democratic leadership, but he will now be one of 10, and he will no doubt be under some pressure to defend the indefensible. You'll listen to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. That was some of Dirty Jobs, a bit of class rage set to music in 1973 by The Who. Next, Larry Cohen. He's the former president of the Communications Workers of America, one of the few unions of any significance that endorsed Bernie Sanders in the primary. He's now the chair of Our Revolution, the successor organization to the Bernie Sanders campaign. What's their strategy? Here's Larry Cohen to tell us. What is Our Revolution? Tell us about the organization and its origins. We know, you know, it's the successor to the Bernie campaign, but tell us more about its structure and intentions.
Sure. So it launched actually on August 24th. It's a 501c4, meaning that it has a board. The board is, you know, pretty amazing folks. People like Nina Turner and Ben Jealous and Jim Hightower, Shailene Woodley, 11 of us all together. Has a great staff of people, mostly from the campaign. Its purpose is a range of things, from building sort of political structure state by state, encouraging people to do it. It's very much sort of disconnected, sometimes connected local groups, some of them operating now on a state basis. It's, you know, on the outside, it's 5 million people who get a lot of emails and are mostly very nice about getting them. It's, you know, also the people who previously raised the money, the famous $27 for the Bernie campaign, have funded this. It's also been about candidates, mostly from those local groups, somewhat from Bernie himself. During the campaign, about 105 people were supported by Our Revolution. It meant the money was raised for them that went directly to them. It meant that people turned out. We organized people for their events, you know, operating independently of their campaign, but also organized people to do phone calling and texting, personal texting, to turn people out. There were ballot measures. Some turned out well, but in all cases, people were very enthusiastic, like Prop 61, which we lost. I mean, we were just a part of a coalition there to on pharmaceutical prices in California to say that the state should be able to pay the same as the Veterans Administration. Or an important one in Howard County, Maryland, a big county in Maryland, we passed small donor match, and we were a big part of that coalition. In that county, we had 8,000 people, for example, that we could mobilize that were in our supporter list, and they ranged from volunteering and to voters, the whole range of things that people do, and also raised $40,000 for that ballot measure, which was a lot, and it passed, and so now they have small donor match. And then our big national issue was the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and in just those couple of months, very proud, we targeted certain congressional districts, which in almost every case was a congressional Democrat that was on the fence. I mean, a House Democrat. They were all House members. And our volunteers called, literally almost 50,000 people in about seven different of those districts, who in many cases, while we were still on the phone, patched through to the congressional office to say, we're against the TPP. And because of the campaign, it was amazing when our people were called. So this is calling people in the districts in the thousands, so that the House member would know that thousands of people in their district were tuned in on TPP, and then hundreds of them immediately called from that call. They were patched through. So that was a huge issue event. The Dakota Pipeline right now, it's a regional issue, but it's a national mobilization for us. And we've gotten, well over 100,000 people on petitions to the president and previously to Hillary Clinton to change her stand. We raised over $100,000 directly for the nations there. So that's a lot of it.
You guys are the heirs to a giant mailing list, I imagine.
Yeah, it's mostly, yes, a mailing list, but we mostly use it digitally. So it's texting. It's texting and emails mostly. But yeah, we could mail. We didn't. We haven't actually mailed any.
No, I meant email list. How big is it? And what do you plan to do with it?
Well, it's in the millions. The key is to link people into local networks, which are all over the place, and they don't always agree with each other, but they're in every country. So that's every country in every state. And also in virtually every county in every state. So when we did the original TPP mobilization, that was a more traditional one where we emailed people, they clicked and they got connected to their House members. So we reached people in all 435 districts, made the calls. We didn't just reach them. They called their member of Congress. So it's a combination of that kind of national issue mobilization and state mobilization and getting people involved and people running for office and in ballot measures, but also building political structure. So like in Nebraska, contested election in the Democratic Party, we work inside and outside the Democratic Party, but in this case, and we were able to elect Jane Klebb, the head of Bold Nebraska, to be party chair for the Democratic Party as of December 15th. So it's a combination of all those kinds of things.
A large national email list of the sort that you have could seem like rather insubstantial, but also rather top-down thing. So how do you connect that with grassroots organizing?
So we set up tools that these grassroots groups, I don't know the number, but there's at least 1,000 of them from the campaign, and many of them are continuing, that they're able to email the people in their area, not just us, number one. Number two, in a growing number of states, there are state organizing committees, and everything would, not everything, but many things would come from them. We're encouraging the 1,900 Bernie delegates to continue to operate in our revolution in a state that's further along. They're in different places. Further along, the delegates in that state are the basis, or one of the bases of those organizing committees. And then there's also organizations. They could be unions, environmental groups, community groups that are part. And going forward, endorsements, things like that will be done that way. In the case of this election, because it was August 24th to November 8th, it was more a combination of local groups saying, hey, endorse so-and-so, and individual people saying endorse so-and-so, which isn't so great. But that's how it was done.
I imagine that you expected you would be now lobbying Hillary Clinton to show some allegiance to the platform she agreed to that didn't necessarily represent her heartfelt politics. But now you have a very different situation with Donald Trump about to take the oath of office. What's your plan going to be to deal with this Trump administration? And, all the fires have already broken out, like the Bannon nomination and things like that. How do you think about fighting this, which is, there are a lot of terrifying prospects here?
So our board met last Sunday and Monday, and actually the statement is on the ourrevolution.com website from that board. It's 5 points. Obviously, I'm not going to read it, but the first one is resistance, that attacks on the rights of immigrants, people of color, indigenous nations, LGBTQ communities, working class, or religious minorities will be met by resistance and solidarity. So that's the first point. And the second one is basically the narrative that people heard in the campaign. We need an economy that works for all, economic justice, fight the oligopoly, big Bernie word, getting big money out of politics, expanding voting rights, foreign policy that works towards peace. So that's sort of the big narrative. The third point is Dakota Pipeline, and a bunch of us sat in yesterday at Army Corps of Engineers headquarters here in D.C., but also we helped get people. We got about 500 of our people, or about 500 out of the 3,000 who showed up yesterday, because we do keep track, but all over the country, turning people out to events that were organized by 350 and other groups. We weren't the prime organizer. So Dakota Pipeline is a huge thing to us. We're petitioning. Well, you mentioned Hillary Clinton. We had done a petition that got well over 100,000 people on it to demand that Hillary Clinton modify her view and support Standing Rock Sioux and other nations there. Now, that's shifting to the president in his last 60 or so days that he steps in, and obviously the Army Corps of Engineers themselves could do it. That's why we were there yesterday. And then four, we're supporting Keith Ellison for the head of the Democratic Party. The board endorsed him Sunday, and we will be, you know, campaigning in each state to get to, it's an insider election of about 450 members of the DNC to build support for Keith.
If people want to lobby on this, who do they lobby? I mean, you say 450. Are these like local worthies who constitute the voters?
Yeah. Well, they're set up by state. So each state has their party chair and their two committee people. So it starts with those three. That's 150. And then the rest of them, you know, it's sort of a hodgepodge how people get on. I happen to be on there, so I'm self-critical of it. But it's a hodgepodge of how people are on there. But that's who decides. And obviously, that's why we say we operate inside and outside the Democratic Party. There's lots of flaws in it. But, you know, we do believe that electing Keith there is a step forward in terms of the political perspective in the country. And we're going to mobilize people state by state to push their representatives in that party. That vote will be in the end of the middle of February, roughly. It's not set yet. The fifth thing is that people are using online tools state by state to decide what their state issues are or local issues. And that's an ongoing focus as well. So like in Maryland, where they have a state organizing committee, they sent out a survey last week. They asked people, hey, will you host an event? So, you know, the well-known Bernie events that were hosted, this would just be in Maryland, our revolution. 600 people agreed to host events in Maryland to talk about, you know, an online thing where they'd be talking about what are the state issues. Everybody was surveyed, 38,000 people in Maryland, roughly. Which, how would you rank these six issues? These are state issues, so, you know, to prioritize what people would work on. So anyway, that's the last point, is a lot of this is local and state-based work, and people in those states will figure it out, and we'll support them.
I'm speaking with Larry Cohen, who's the chair of Our Revolution, former president of the Communication Workers of America. And how much of the work do you see is going to be electoral, and how much is issue-oriented? You know, will it all be about endorsing candidates, or will it be broader than that?
So we will have a coordinated pack, but I've only been talking about, first of all, that's in the months ahead. But no, this is a C4, so, and it's a member-based C4, so it means that...
Now, that may be arcane to a lot of people. What does a C3 versus a C4 mean?
The implications are, to answer your question, the majority of the work has to be non-political, meaning issue-based work and not electoral. But it could be 55, 45, in that kind of range. It'll be both, is the answer. But by law, it has to be at least more than half not electoral.
And you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but Bernie was never a Democrat till he ran for president. What is your relationship going to be to the party?
So most of our folks are supporting people who have, you know, to get a nomination or to run. You know, as you know, in many states now, increasing number, it doesn't really matter. You're California, Washington, they have a primary, but the top two in the primary go in the general. But in many states, to have any realistic chance of winning, our folks have supported Democrats in primaries, lots of primary activity. So that's another thing. Way more primary activity, or at least as much as general election activity. But we also supported, for example, in Richmond, California, two members of Richmond Progressive Association who were running against Democrats, and They won, the RPA people. You know, we helped. We're not the main reason they won, but we did raise money and supported them and turned out our voters. It's a heavy Bernie area, Richmond. And they're, you know, they actually defeated two Democrats. Or even Pramila Jayapal, which is one of our top, maybe in the top national, you know, congressional race that we were involved in. She was running against another Democrat in the general election because of the way Washington operates. Somebody we would call a corporate Democrat, and she's an immigration leader and housing leader and in the state legislature. And, you know, that was a key race in terms of resources we raised and the number of our folks who turned out. So it's both. But, you know, realistically, more people are involved still fighting to change the Democratic Party itself or candidates that identify as Democrats than as independents. But, you know, we believe, as you just said, like Bernie, where there's opportunities for that and where our local people support those folks to do that. And Vermont is a place where David Zuckerman, who came from the Vermont Progressive Party, then cross-filed and won a contested primary as a Democrat. He won as lieutenant governor last week. That was another top election for us.
And what about the relation with the labor movement, which is, you know, often a very reliable supporter of the mainstream Democratic Party? There were some that broke away and endorsed Sanders, but, you know, there's a pretty strong endorsement for Hillary Clinton quite early. What about the relationship with organized labor, which, you know, sometimes seems like a subsidiary of the Democratic Party?
Yeah, so the unions that supported Bernie are what we call our organizational partners. There's also other, you know, non-labor groups in that category, but you know, those are the ones that have the most impact here and where the biggest number of members are coming from. So that would be, you know, my union, the CWA, Communication Workers, the National Nurses United, Amalgamated Transit Union, Postal Workers Union, the West Coast Dockers, International Longshore and Warehouse Union. Then there are 100 local unions that many of them were from unions that didn't endorse at all, industrial unions or like the electricians. And then there were, you know, depending on which number we count, 15 to 60,000 individual people as union activists who were involved in the campaign, the 15,000 very actively, the other more passively, but still involved. So that's how we relate. I mean, it's not through, I mean, as you mentioned, a lot of the bigger unions, the biggest unions had endorsed Clinton, and at this point, they haven't partnered with this.
And finally, what's your explanation of the election results? What does the Trump victory tell us about the state of politics in this country?
Yeah, there's the big question. Thanks. I'm glad we got the easier ones first.
Yes, I sort of ease you into it.
Yes, you did. So, you know, our view is shaped by our experience in the primary. I mean, we believe that you do have to go deeper in terms of what you're fighting for to attract and energize, you know, working class voters, regardless of, you know, where they live, what their background is, what color they are, their sexual orientation. And this is a little bit because of how we saw the primary. We think that when you dive into places like Wilkes-Barre and Scranton, Pennsylvania, and you see a huge fall off from the Obama vote to the vote this year for Hillary Clinton, that it is at least somewhat about people saying, hey, you know, we're fed up and we don't like what's going on as it is, that's at least part of the explanation. I saw a good article. Somebody dived into Mexico, Maine. That's the name of the town, small town, that had gone overwhelmingly for Obama and then went, you know, last time and then went for Trump, and sort of amazing stuff. I mean, it's more anecdotal there because there's only 100 voters, but, you know, you get to see a picture there of that kind of thing. You know, I don't think it's an easy thing to explain, and we should remember she won the popular vote. Any other country, she'd be the president-elect. Nobody else has a system like this in the world. You know, it's designed to not focus first on the popular vote, to first focus on states. You know, we don't want to minimize what her accomplishment was and that, you know, she won the popular vote. But I do think when you look at Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio, and Michigan going for Trump, that and what I saw on the campaign, I was actively involved in those states. And even in Iowa, I was involved mostly in the, you know, eastern Iowa, the industrial towns. You know, people are fed up with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's not going to be one thing, though, that explains it. And they didn't view her as a candidate that was really going to say that, hey, we're going to fight for manufacturing jobs in the U.S. You know, she did come to that position, and we cheered it. But it's not like, you know, the way in which Bernie Sanders campaigned on it. So I think that is one of the variables that we have to take away from this, is that if we're going to attract and energize you know, working class voters who are obviously the bulk of this country. We need a much more clear position that that their lives and their families come first and not the fundraisers.
And without ceding any ground to the xenophobia.
Yeah, exactly. And we will fight it. As I said, that's the number one thing on the board statement that came out of here, is fighting that stuff. But I think that you see that gets unchecked to a certain extent when it's perceived that that the conventional party, and that would be both parties, because Trump defeated the conventional Republican Party, all 16 of them, aren't focused on your day-to-day life. They don't represent any kind of rebellion against the status quo. So I don't think that's the cause of the racism and hatred and xenophobia, but I do think that the bulk of the people that voted for Trump are not in that category at all. They're more in a category of we're fed up and we don't want to see a continuation of what we have.
That was Larry Cohen, former president of the Communication Workers of America and now the chair of Our Revolution, the successor to the Bernie Sanders campaign. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of the Mekons' Fear and Beer, Hymn for Brexit, released right after last June's vote. Till next week, bye.
Dismal man in dreary sea towns buzz around like flies. Someone said, we know what you're thinking, try this on for size. Deep and still, blood on the pavement, sticks and stones, hold them in your hands, a pint of beer, then home by tea time, for we are afraid. Come with us, oh come along, there's something going wrong. A steam train for Jerusalem departs for ancient times. Deep and still.